Good afternoon, and welcome to We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
And I just wowed Bob. I just took my windbreaker off, and I am wearing safety cone.
Whoa, that is
orange.
I wondered why my glasses all of a sudden auto-darkened.
I know. I did it. I did it because we're talking about terrorism, so you know what?
There you go.
On behalf of the team,
You're a target.
I'm the target.
Yeah.
Okay, it was handy.
Do not adjust your set.
I am dressed for radio. My computer's dressed for radio, too. Darn thing. Here, Bill's computer's screwed up all the time. He comes in, opens it up.
I'm the smart guy today.
It totally works. Here, I'm busting a move trying to get my computer to... Getting all the, everything all updated. Yep. Nope.
Not the way it is. Hey, we got an exciting show today.
Yes, and I can actually read about it on my phone.
My
technology
has
not totally failed us. Yuck. All right, so we're talking about terrorism. Terrorism, counterterrorism, and all the terrorism in between.
But there really hasn't been any terrorism
No,
this
hardly
year.
Any. Hardly
this
any.
Year there hasn't been hardly any.
So we have a document actually loaded on the website at wethepeopleradio.us that you can see. You can download it, too, if you'd like. We got it from our guest, Bruce Moran.
Yes, you should download it and go to the bottom where it gives you a total of terrorist attacks since January 1st.
Of this year. It's like 640, right?
Yeah. So when people say, oh, gee, the terrorist attacks are really down now.
Right. It's hardly happening at all.
Yeah.
Hardly at all.
We have Claire on the line as well now.
Nice. Okay. Everybody's there. Everybody but my computer is in the game.
put me in, coach.
Exactly. Whoops.
Uh-oh. Okay. Sorry, I didn't mean it.
Somebody's not wearing their safety cone orange shirt.
Apparently, we no longer have Claire.
Oh. Hey, this is.
But we have Bruce.
Is this where we go Cool Hand Luke and we talk about the failure to communicate?
Apparently.
All right. So, Bruce Moran, let's talk about him. He is a national security advisor who focuses on strategic planning for national security issues. You're thinking, this guy sounds familiar. He is, because we have him on periodically. He sends us all sorts of great updates from the White House and stuff like that. And so as a consultant, he works with public officials, U.S. government committees, departments, agencies, think tanks, and corporations, and us. So there's mostly nobody is left out. So he's working with anybody who's paying attention. He works on special national security projects and defines clear hands-on working solutions for crisis preparedness and crisis readiness scenarios. He is with Security Solutions Technologies. And then it sounds like if I'm multitasking correctly with my ears, Claire Lopez might have been jumped in.
She is.
And this will be the first time Claire's ever been with us when she wasn't driving.
Yes.
Claire is not going through a mountain range today that we know of.
No, I am not. I am stationary today.
Nice. How nice for you, actually. And fun for us. So Claire is going to be our crossover guest. She'll be here for the first hour with Bruce, and she'll be here in the second hour with Dr. Lyle Rapacki. So let's tell you about Claire. And I won't read the whole thing in case people are out there going, stop it. Claire is a strategic policy and intelligence expert with a focus on national defense, Islam, Iran, and counterterrorism issues. So she fits in nicely to this dialogue. Currently a senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy and vice president of the Intelligence Summit. Formerly was a career operations officer with the CIA, a professor at the Center for Counterintelligence and Security Studies. She's obviously very close to crime because I believe those are her sirens that are going off in the background.
No, not mine.
Not your sirens?
No.
Oh, yeah. Bruce is in Chicago. Sorry, Bruce. Your sirens. Chicago hasn't changed at all. So we haven't heard Bruce yet. Say hi, Bruce. Are you in there?
I'm here someplace.
Yeah, hanging out.
Yep,
we still got your picture up as Hawkeye Pierce, so you'll be providing the comic relief when we're not headbutting the microphone or some other foolishness.
We're having a blues fest here, a lit fest, so it's crowded
nice.
In downtown Chicago. So a lot of action going on.
Sounds like a good day to be inside talking on the radio.
And 90 degrees.
God, that's joyous.
We're usually in the 70, high 70s.
See, and it's like 60-something here today. And usually here it's like 115 by now.
I think is indicative of what's going on in the world and how terror and a lot of us think about it is people really don't understand the dynamic of terrorism. As they can look onto your website, just up until June 4th this year, there were 640 incidences. So it's really hard to wrap your mind around the degree and the multitude of terror incidents and how it's impacting people around the world. Last year, there were 1,813, so we're on pace with that, or it could be a little below or a little above, but it's pervasive, and it's brutal. It's ugly. As you know, we're looking at the genocide that's going on in Iraq, Syria. We're seeing all types of savage crucifixions, people are being roasted. All these type of things are part and parcel to what's going on, what we need to stop right now. So if we're looking at President Trump, he was overseas about a week and a half ago, and he started a participatory group of people with the Arab leaders to now lock it down, stop the terrorism. And so we're seeing them, you know, I don't know if anybody knows anything about Qatar, but it's a terror-sponsored, basically, state, and they fund a lot of these groups through their oil. It's right off the, you know, Gulf right there, so they're oil-rich. And the things we're looking at is how do you contain it first, and then how do you stop it? What we're doing in Mosul right now is containing it in Raqqa. They're hitting on the door of the principal ISIS headquarters right now in Raqqa as of yesterday. And then we also have troops there in the Philippines. So we're looking at a lot of different avenues to, you know, stop this jihad. I like to call it jihad and terrorism. And then they look at it from their point of view as martyrdom. So they don't want to look at it as suicide, but they think they're doing something religious in terms of being a martyr, and then I'll let Claire start from there. So,
yeah, that's an interesting point, Claire. What do you do? I mean, how do you control or stop somebody who has that mindset that doesn't care if they get killed in the act?
Well, I mean, at a certain level, the forces of those who are willing to kill and be killed, as the Quran says, must be suppressed forcibly. But I would actually step back from talking about terrorism. We're not fighting terrorism. That's not what this is about. I would even stop talking about it because that is simply one small sliver of the overall jihad that's coming against us, and it's a much smaller part of the overall offensive than the rest of it. Security services, intelligence services, law enforcement need to pay attention to this. We, the rest of us, need to stop focusing on terrorism and begin talking about the overall jihad, the civilization jihad, which is nonviolent, non-kinetic, and what it is doing in terms of infiltration, information operations and subversion inside of the West, Western countries, including our own.
Okay.
Nice. And so how do you do that?
Well, people
have to get smarter.
The first thing to do is to understand the doctrine that inspires these forces of jihad. And the inspiration for jihad, whether it be of the violent kind or the civilization kind, comes directly from Islamic doctrine, law, and scripture. So we first have to say that. We have to understand the enemy's threat doctrine, which derives from the doctrine, the law, and the scripture of Islam. All of our national security senior officials, Pentagon, Homeland Security, intelligence community, you name it, need to go back to school and take courses on Islamic doctrine, law, and scripture, and understand that that is the driving inspiration for those who engage in jihad, whether civilizational jihad or violent kind. After that, then you have to understand how they're coming at us and from which lines of effort. Another way to put that is the way our brilliant friend Steve Coughlin, senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy and also the president of Unconstrained Analytics, his company, talks about the Maoist splinter movement theory. And all that means is that the enemy uses different lines of effort to attack what I call the pillars of support of society. And I mean by that academia, the courts, the faith communities, local law enforcement, national government and national security, all of these different pillars of support that keep up a society, a Western society. They have lines of effort coming against them, nothing to do with terrorism. But that is how a society is penetrated, like from within, as their own documents say, and debilitated from within, so that when a society gets to the point of Western civilization in Western Europe, and what we're seeing going on in Britain and France and Belgium and the Netherlands and Sweden, those societies are already corroded from within. They have no more support. They have nothing holding them up anymore. And at that point, then the final push comes from violent jihad, and over they go, and they succumb and submit to Sharia, because, of course, that's the objective. They're not just trying to kill people. That's not what they're trying to do. It's not Genghis Khan and piles of skulls. It is about living people. They want people alive to be under Sharia, Islamic law.
Right. They want to be able to control the society. Now, in what's going on in Britain right now, I think has been accelerated to this point by their previous policies of multiculturalism, which has allowed this vast takeover, if you will, of their society. Is there any coming back from that at this point for them?
Well, I wish them all the best, of course. But I'll go back again to my good friend and brilliant scholar, Steve Coughlin, who talks about what is happening now to Western Europe and also to us as really the continuation of at least a century or more of cultural Marxism, progressivism, that began in the time of President Teddy Roosevelt, if not sooner, and has been developing and extending and expanding ever since inside of our Western societies. This is where ideas about the relativism of the value of different cultures come from, how a concept of multiculturalism can be accepted when there is no more critical thinking to allow discrimination, which is actually a good word,
right?
A discrimination between the good, the better, and the best of societies and of cultures and civilizations. When you no longer have that, then multiculturalism can set in, and you know, everybody's the same as everybody else. Even if you like to cut off heads and marry 6-year-olds, that's okay.
Right.
Right. And we can't talk about it. You know, we're not supposed to talk about it because that makes us mean. We need to take a really quick break, but you can get an idea of where we're headed today. And we have plenty more where that came from. We'll be right back with Claire Lopez and Bruce Moran. We're not talking about terrorism. I like that. We're going to stop talking about it, start talking about jihad, because that's really what's in the news.
Cultural takeover.
We'll be right back.
Thank you.
we're back. Without further ado, we're trying to connect Bruce so he can hear you, Claire. The reason he's not saying anything is he can't hear us. So while we do that, maybe you could continue with that thought before you were so rudely interrupted.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was emphasizing the point that unless a people, a civilization, know and value who they are, they will not be capable of defending themselves or that civilization from those who would destroy it. And so we as Americans need to get reacquainted with our foundational documents, certainly our Declaration, our Constitution, Bill of Rights, read more of what the Founding Fathers wrote at the Federalist Papers, for example. And then a more recent book I would recommend is one by Samuel Huntington called Who We Are. That's the name of it, Who We Are. And the book describes who founded this country, who were the settlers and the pioneers and the original people who came to this country, settled it, and from among whom arose the Founding Fathers who then took the 13 colonies and turned them into a country. So it's critical to know who we are, what it is that we value, what are those first things, principles that are so dear to us that we'll fight and die to preserve them. I would suggest that among those for us as Americans are the concept of individual liberty, the idea of government by the consent of the governed under rule of man-made law, equality for all in human dignity under the law. As a matter of fact, our name, we are a republic. That word comes from two Latin words, res publica, the public thing. That public thing is the law. That's what sets us apart from all other places. That's why we are exceptional. Now, the irony of all of this, of course, is that so many of our founding fathers actually began life as British citizens. And we as Americans take much of you know, what went into our foundational concepts and principles from the British, as well as other luminaries of the Enlightenment period in Western Europe. And then, of course, going all the way back, I would say we are also of Athens and of Rome, as well as Jerusalem. Of Athens, because that is the first place where independent city-states took hold and ruled themselves as independent city-states. From the Greeks, we also have concepts of philosophy and humanism and logic and reasoning. Rome, because that, during the Republican period, was the place where civil administration with representation from the population, not equal, but the beginnings of that arose. And then Jerusalem, of course, because our foundational documents are Judeo-Christian based, and Jerusalem, of course, is the place where those concepts arose in first Judaism and then Christianity.
And that always sends the left into complete hysterics.
Yes, well, I wonder how you know, hysterical they'd be if their entire civilization were being swept away. Maybe they wouldn't mind.
Yeah, and it's interesting because all the jihadist guys, whether they come from Pakistan or Iran or wherever they come from, they all are operating on a basis of knowledge of their, you know, like them or not, founding principles, I guess, if you will. They're not looking at anything multicultural. They're not looking to fit in or they're looking to impose what they believe onto everybody else, period.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is the inequality of this fight we're in right now. The enemy we face, again, the forces of Islamic Jihad and Sharia, those forces are absolutely rock solid in their beliefs, in their understanding of their own foundational principles, which are completely antithetical to our own. But what I'm contrasting here is the commitment, the devotion, the faithfulness of Muslims to their foundational principles and doctrine. and certainly looking at places in Western Europe and a great deal of the wasteland on American campuses, for example, and in the media in this country, the complete lack of understanding of our foundational principles, allegiance to them, or commitment to preserving them.
And I think probably one place that is more obvious than anywhere is our college campuses today. And look what's going on there. And how did that happen? And how do we get that turned around when these, you know, with these professors? And actually, they're even turning on the professors now. But
well, they turn on the professors, then the professors turn on the professors. I mean, that's, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, our college campuses also have become wastelands. Rather uniformly unacquainted with critical thinking or the Founding Fathers' principles. And I'll go back here then again to cultural Marxism imposed in this country as far back as the 19th century began, Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, the Franklin School, all of that infiltrated academia. And then, of course, graduates of that learning from academia went back into academia as professors, but also to media and the government. And so what we have today is that all of the key vehicles of thought and what is supposed to be, you know, the bastions and the repositories of our cultural and civilizational principles and knowledge are all in the hands of those who despise them. And to turn that around is going to take a very serious effort, and it's going to be multi-generational, I think, just as the destruction of those pillars of society has taken generations.
Yeah, and I guess what's really frightening is these kids that are coming out of these campuses today, unfortunately, you're going to come out with an education that has no grounding at all to what this country's really about. Or, you know, I mean, they're even rewriting a lot of these textbooks and excluding, like the Federalist Papers and history about our founding fathers.
They're excluding pieces of history, obviously,
exactly.
Large pieces of history.
And so how, I mean, that's got to have a detrimental effect on our future country.
Yeah, absolutely. And so one of our tasks will be to correct the textbooks, correct the mistakes, restore balance to different periods of history and, elements of civilizational background and history and so forth contained in those textbooks. And then also, I mean, this is the responsibility for us who have children, grandchildren, nieces, nephews, young people in the family, that we do the best that we can to be an influence for the positive for them, no matter what it may be they're getting on the college campuses, but that they receive from the family, from the broader family.
Right,
you know,
yeah.
Or any young people that we have contact with, balancing input on these critical subjects. And then finally, I would say we might have some hope in the fact that youth are often, emotional and impressionable and all of those sorts of things, and a lot of them sort of straighten up as they get older.
Well, it's interesting because I have, 14 nieces and nephews, and the bulk of them are out of college. And, you know, they went in, they got their degrees in useful things, they got out, they're working. And those kids never participated in, well, we just aren't those kind of people, but they didn't participate in burning down Starbucks or wearing a mask and, you know, throwing things at the police. They went to schools where some of that was going on, but chose not to participate. So, I mean, by way, for people who don't have anybody in that system, they're not all participating. But I'd be curious to know what you think.
But families do
Oh yeah, that's
have
the
a great deal of responsibility and influence, and we shouldn't minimize that.
No,
anyway.
No, they should take every aspect of that and use it, because the upbringing does count if you make it count. Mm-hmm. I was going to ask you. I know we have to take another break here, but I was going to ask you. Yesterday was a Act for America. I think Act for America put a nationwide call out for rallies against Sharia, and I'm not an expert on what they were doing, but I had somebody call me from outside of Sacramento and was really frustrated because they had traffic all tied up and all that. And now this person knows, I mean, familiar with the jihad. I mean, this isn't somebody who's a multicultural, purveyor, and yet felt that it was completely stupid for them to be protesting where they were, because it just isn't, Sharia law isn't something that's going to happen here. It's not a threat, and it's stupid that these people were all tying up traffic to protest something that's never coming.
Well, I mean, for any of us who has been stuck in California, Los Angeles, traffic jams, I sympathize. It goes to show the extent of the educational effort that we need to make. Sharia is Islam. Islam is Sharia. You don't have the one without the other.
And it's not an impossibility.
What?
The idea that would... I mean, don't they have Sharia courts in, like, Dearborn and some of these places? I know they do in London.
Not openly. Not officially. I suspect that in many Islamic centers and mosques, there are informal Islamic tribunals going on, but not openly and not in a public way.
Sure. It's just, I thought it was interesting that the commentary, you know, well, this isn't going to happen here. I don't know why people are even protesting this. It's not an issue here. And I thought...
Well, I'll actually add to that, and that I was doing this on Twitter this morning, actually. The question came up. The Center for Security Policy, again, where I am the Vice President for Research and Analysis online, www.centerforsecuritypolicy.org, or shorter, www.securefreedom.org. We have published now two separate compilations of legal cases, and you can find the references to those at our website, on Sharia, Islamic law, making an entry or a presence inside U.S. courts. We went through hundreds and hundreds of cases. We had to trim it down and bound it somehow. So we decided to look only at the state appellate court level across the United States, just to trim the number of cases down to something manageable. And then we published these two studies, one in, I think it was 2011, and one in 2015. Find them at our website, Sharia in American Courts. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cases where Sharia was introduced in some way or other by the defense, the prosecution, the judge, whomever. And it doesn't mean necessarily that Sharia decided the case, but rather that it was introduced in some way to the case. It's already here.
Yeah.
It's already in our courts.
Yeah, it's fascinating that it's even allowed... to come into the case at all. One of the books that we highlight on our site is a book called It's All About Muhammad. That book will give you a lot of insight into Islam. It's basically a biography of Muhammad, but it shows you...
So if you think Muhammad was a peaceful prophet,
yes.
Guess again.
Yeah, guess again. I mean, but it really gives you some insight where this is coming from.
And now we celebrate capitalism for 2 minutes, and we'll be right back.
Underground.
Sounds like a little crazy train, eh?
Nice. Yeah, it's amazing how songs like The Crazy Train start sounding like reality after a while. So, hey, we should say hi to Bruce because he's had sound problems on and off, and we've had him in the cone of silence.
Well, we're that's one of the factors we're looking at, what Claire's talking about. I think that's very important because we're really concerned about what's going on in the college campuses with the professors, the ideology, the pedagogy, you know, the that's the way they're being taught and the impact it's having on them. But I'm looking at it from the other side of the equation. What can we do now from the people who are understanding this to lock it down? And we need to really understand it's hybrid and asymmetrical guerrilla warfare. And it's heavily dutied spycraft trade, clandestine activity, and they're in our country now. College students aren't going to do anything about that. You have to have people on the ground and people understanding what to do in law, you know, with law and order now to handle the situation. President Trump is dealing directly with that, with his law and order program. One of the things I'm looking at also is, what is this, when I'm talking about hybrid, asymmetrical guerrilla warfare? Well, if you look at the Gulf War, that's when we first started, you know, insinuating ourselves in Iraq and Saddam Hussein. But the ideas of what happened at that time and now are completely different. How they're trained, what they come to know, and being a jihadist is completely different. They're more sophisticated, both in the spycraft trade and both in how to assimilate into a culture and then infiltrate. And I want to emphasize that because we need to be aware. We need to look, learn, and listen. I wrote that on the website, so people take a look at that. That's a critical part of what I need to, you know, convey today from my perspective. We'll talk in the intermediate term. I would talk about what Claire is saying in Sharia law, and we got to know that, and it goes back, you know, the Caliphate state. But in terms of a broken arrow situation, what President Trump is dealing with right now, he's delivering. He's making sure our entire intelligence corps, our entire military is focused on stopping this action of the hybrid asymmetrical guerrilla warfare that's happening all throughout Europe. It's unquestionably confounding to them because they don't know what they're doing in terms of how to implement a tactical operational program to make sure it doesn't happen. What we're looking at also is how are they addressing it on the front of it, not on the backside. And what I'm talking about is knee-jerk reactions. It's easy to say when something happens, we're doing our best and then we're going to follow up. It's to prevent it from happening in the first place, and how are you going to prevent it? What are you doing to get it there? And then how are you going to institute programs, law and order, in order to make it effective operationally? And that's where my major concerns are right now. We're in the Ramadan period, and that's ending, I think, June 20th, but that's one of the high, you know, high activities of martyrdom for the jihadists. And we're coming upon our 4th of July. So that's, you know, last year was Bastille for the French when he drove that truck and he mowed down all those people and killed everybody. So these are the kind of things I'm looking at to keep people aware now. The college students, I live where there's, you know, five different campuses, and it's a totally different environment. It's carefree. They don't really think about things like I'm talking about right now. It's not a serious environment, you know, critical thinking, like Claire is saying, it's not really there for this type of situation. So what we have to look at is how do we, as people who are looking at it from the terrorist point of view and how it operationally works, make sure it doesn't happen in the United States.
So you don't think, Bruce, that the college campuses are sort of turning into a kind of a breeding ground for this kind of activity?
Oh, sure, but we can't do anything about that in that respect. We got to make sure that they are informed, but we got to work above them and below them to find out how it's going on. That's what I'm saying. You need operations to be effective where they don't know what they're doing in terms of the
right
relationships they're establishing with people who have already infiltrated them. I think Claire will agree with that. They don't understand that they're there to usurp anything they want to do in terms of helping these people out. through their multiculturalism. We're not there in what we're trying to do on our end. We're trying to lock it down, be effective, and know when it's going on. You can help, you know, on the campuses, sure, but the professors aren't supporting these efforts, especially in, you know, a lot of larger college campuses. They're not geared towards that. That's not their direction.
I guess so, the scary part is they're doing nothing to discourage.
For the intermediate, I would say that's a good goal. For objectives, that's a good goal, but not for tactical operations and implementing programs right now. We have to have more people that are like Claire, like me, that are moving around, looking at things, watching how they're going down, who are they dealing with, looking at how it's happening, who they're happening with, aiding and abetting, and that's the critical factor. How is this all happening, and it's aiding and abetting? That's not always taken a close look at. Look, you know, so.
Sure.
I'm
sure.
Getting a little upset here, so. it's compounding because it's so pervasive and it's so insidious that it has to be addressed in that fashion. You got to take a look at it in a hard way, and the students aren't looking at it that way. You can't rely on them. That's what I'm saying, in that capacity, or the professors.
I know
you have
that
to be part of their organizations and work with them, but you got to work around them more than you're working with them because they don't know what they're doing.
Sure.
In that capacity.
And I know that neither of you can, you know, see the future. At least that's not the way we promoted the program. So if I'm wrong, let me know. But
welcome to Coast to Coast AM.
Yeah, exactly. That's a much later show. Actually, I'm curious, though, how long before you guys think that the London type of stuff, you know, this really repetitive, seems to be happening a lot, before that sort of thing starts here? How well set up, I guess, do you think they are here in our own country?
They're well established already. So
that's what I was afraid of.
There's no doubt they've infiltrated and they're well established. So that's what I'm talking about. How do we deal with it, like Claire and I and Lyle and different people who are working with law enforcement or, you know, border security? And like President Trump, you know, started the border security program as soon as he got in, and that, you know, cut down on people coming in. But say you cut down on 50% of people coming in. The other 50% coming through are the ones who are more sophisticated.
Sure.
They're the ones that have the money. They're the ones that get the arms. They're the ones that are infiltrating. So you're locking down, but you have to start getting better at it. You have to have 24/7 operations on the border. And then you got to fully implement the border security program, north and south borders also.
Is it?
Because we'll end up in the same situation Britain is or France is, and you can't have it. You can't have it because people are going to suffer, people are going to die, and it's going to be a travesty. This is a very, very tenuous situation we're in.
I'll
leave the floor now. I'll let Claire speak a little bit. So,
well, I would say that in terms of the kind of jihad violence that we're seeing in places like Britain and France and Belgium, we are a number of years away from that, probably a good 5, 7, even 10 years away.
Why is that?
Because of a couple of things. One is that we don't have the geographical proximity to the Middle East that Europe does, which facilitated the influx of so many hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Muslims.
Hooray for the Atlantic Ocean.
Into their territories. So when you look at Britain today, it's got, 5 or 6% Muslims? France is well over 10%. Belgium and the Netherlands, maybe around 4%, maybe 5% maximum. So they have much higher levels of Muslims in their populations already. And the United States doesn't have that, like I said, geographical proximity to the source of, you know, from the Middle East and those battlefields and so forth. And those who are here in the United States are coming in through other kinds of programs, immigration, refugee resettlement, and we are currently at approximately 3.345 million Muslims in this country, which amounts to something less than 1% of our population, which is around 315 or 20 million at this point in time. So it is very much a matter of the numbers. And it's also a matter of within those numbers, back to Mao again, the sea in which the jihadis swim. So when you have larger and larger populations of Muslims, you are going to have larger and larger percentages of those who are Sharia adherent, who are willing to offer safe haven and protection and support, logistics and other support to jihadis, and it becomes a numbers game. And, of course, these Western European countries are much smaller than we are to begin with, and their services have simply become completely overwhelmed. They cannot keep up with them anymore. We heard the number 23,000 suspected jihadis in Britain, of which the services had designated something like 3,000 as of the most concern. Well, to put 24/7 surveillance on one person, you know, you need a team of, you know, approaching 20 people round the clock.
Right.
Okay, multiply that by 3,000. Multiply that by 23,000. They can't do it. They have already become overwhelmed. I don't know how they get out of that without mass deportation and incarceration. Those are the only answers. And if you listen to somebody like Paul Weston, who is a leader of a political party in Britain, and a short video he's got up online, look him up, Paul Weston, W-E-S-T-O-N. This is exactly what he says. At this point, they are in such a situation because of the numbers that they probably cannot get out of it without drastic action, and that must include incarceration and deportation of those who are not citizens.
Wow, and that is a drastic measure to take in a population.
That's one way to look at it, but if you look at 9/11, they were here.
Yeah.
And they infiltrated.
Sure.
And what I was conveying earlier is that the hybrid asymmetrical guerrilla warfare has increased their capabilities. You don't have to have the numbers, you just need small amounts of them to work together as cells and infiltrate. So that's what we're working at. And you don't need to have a lot of people go to a shopping mall or a high school, you know, college and just kill people.
Yeah, and what Claire was...
This is a different situation. I'm taking it from an open society, and we're not looking at it from the terrorist point of view. We have to look at it from the terrorist point of view, what they want to do, what they want to accomplish, what their goals are, and what the effects are going to be. And how dramatic they want. They're looking for a large impact. Now they're looking at cars, you know, instead of, you know, maybe airlines and trucks and different areas on how they're going to be using them to attack. But now it's, even if it's a homegrown or a homegrown as part of a cell unit that's being conducted from different parts in the United States, we need to get a handle on it. That's what I'm talking about. You don't need a lot of them. It's the sheer numbers with, Claire's talking about is certainly a factor, but if you take into account its hybrid asymmetrical guerrilla warfare and it's more sophisticated, and they can put them in computers, they can put them in pop cans, and you can blow a side of the building off, you know. So this is the kind of thing, it's much more detrimental, much more monumental decision-making has to be made, and President Trump is trying to get a handle on that and make his message clear to the American people that as long as his executive orders aren't being executed and he's trying the best he can on the borders, and Claire's, you know, group is coming in from the, you know, ideological and informational point of view, these are all very important facets in how to get our country turned around. And Claire is absolutely right that it's easier on our side because of the oceans, but it's harder here because nobody's paying attention. So I'm looking at it from the harder side because nobody's paying attention. And we got to get the information out there, and we got to get more people out there and hired to actually do what we need to have done.
Right, right. And unfortunately...
So we have... What Claire's saying is true. What I'm saying is true. That's what I'm saying. We're looking at it from two different points of view. But you have to take a realistic point of view is, are we 5 or 6 years away? 9/11 didn't happen 5 or 6 years away. It happened...
But that was state-sponsored. That was Saudi Arabia and Iran doing that. Al-Qaeda carried it out. But those 9/11
but now it's ISIS and
Al-Qaeda.
You know,
Nusra Front.
I mean,
Saudi
they joined
Arabia,
forces and they separated. And we don't know who's combined who in the United States. That's what I'm saying, Claire. You know, they're
and he can't
they're working
hear you,
on different levels, and, you know, we need to be well aware of that fact, and I'm not debating a point. I'm just trying to make clear a point that we don't know a lot, and we don't know how they're operationally here and to what degree. We know they're here. We've been infiltrated, and it's a matter of, you know, in downtown here, this young kid about 3 years ago pulled the plug on a bomb that was going to blow up the people in the financial district here. Those are people I knew. He's only 19 years old. 2 years later, they arrested a friend of his for doing the same thing. I mean, they're homegrown, but they're also, they come from a Pakistani group of people.
And they're traveling in packs, obviously. All right, Claire, next hour, we're going to hear all your response to that because you're sticking with us. Bruce has to go hang out in his world, but you're going to stay with us, and we're going to add Lyle Ropacki to the discussion. So thanks a million, you guys. And just for people listening, I want you to know that a lot of the document that Bruce was referencing is on the website. Please join us online and hang with us for the other hour. We're here at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
Thanks, Bruce.
Okay.
Thank you.